When she washed herself in the gushing spring and marvelled at her fine white hands, she again made the sign of the cross in the air between herself and the dead man. Then her lips quivered, her tongue moved, and the name she had heard sung and spoken so often on their ride through the forest issued from her lips. She said, "Jesus Christus." Then the frog skin fell away, and she was the lovely young girl. Yet her head bowed forward in weariness, her limbs needed rest. She slept. But her slumber was very brief. At midnight she was awakened. In front of her stood the dead horse, so radiant and full of life, with light shining from its eyes and from the wounded neck. Close by appeared the murdered Christian priest. "More beautiful than Balder," the Viking woman would have said, and yet he appeared in flames of fire. There was a solemnity in his big, gentle eyes, a pronouncement of justice, a look so penetrating that it seemed to shine straight into the corners of the heart of the one on trial. Little Helga trembled at the sight, and her memory awoke with the force of Judgment Day. Everything good that had been granted to her, every loving word that had been said to her, seemed to come alive. She understood that it was love that had kept her going during those days of trial, in which the offspring of soul and marsh was fermenting and struggling. She acknowledged that she had merely followed the urgings of her moods and had done nothing on her own. Everything had been given to her, everything had been guided. She bowed, meek, humble, ashamed before the one who had the power to read every fold of her heart. And at that moment she sensed, like a lightning flash from the purifying fire, the flame of the Holy Spirit. "You daughter of the marsh," said the Christian priest, "from the marsh, from the earth have you come. From the earth shall you rise once more. The ray of sunlight in you, conscious of its body, will return to its source, the ray that is not from the sun's body, but the ray from God. No soul shall perish, but long is the temporal life which leads to the eternal. I come from the land of the dead. You too shall one day travel through the deep valleys into the radiant mountains where mercy and perfection dwell. I cannot lead you to Hedeby for a Christian baptism. First you must shatter the watery shield over the deep quagmire, pull out the living root of your life and your cradle. You must perform your deed before consecration can occur." And he lifted her up onto the horse, handing her a golden incense vessel like the one she had seen before in the Viking stronghold. From it came scent, sweet and strong. The open wound in the forehead of the murdered man shone like a radiant diadem. He took the cross from the grave and raised it high in the air. Then they raced off through the sky, above the rustling forest, above the mounds where the warriors were buried, seated on their slaughtered steeds, and the mighty figures rose up, came riding out and halted atop the burial mounds. In the moonlight, the broad gold circlets with the golden nodes glittered around their foreheads, their cloaks fluttered in the wind. The serpent who brooded over the treasure raised its head and looked at them. The dwarf folk peeked out from mounds and ploughed furrows. They teemed with red, blue, and green lights, a swarm to behold, like sparks in the ashes of burned paper. Over forest and heath, rivers and watery meadows they flew, up toward wild bog. Above it they hovered in great circles. The Christian priest raised the cross high. It gleamed like gold, and from his lips sounded the chanting of the Mass. Little Helga sang along, the way a child sings to her mother's song. She swung the incense vessel, making an altar scent appear, so strong, so miraculous, that the reeds and rushes of the bog began to bloom. All the sprouts shot up from the deep bottom. Everything alive rose up. A profusion of water lilies spread all around, like a woven carpet of flowers, and on it lay a sleeping woman, young and lovely. Little Helga thought she was looking at herself, her mirror image in the still water, but it was her mother she saw, the marsh king's wife, the princess from the waters of the Nile. The dead Christian priest commanded the slumbering woman to be lifted onto the horse, but the animal sank under the burden as if its body were merely a shroud flying in the wind. Yet the sign of the cross made the phantom of the air strong, and all three of them rode to dry land. Then the rooster crowed in the Viking's stronghold, and the visions dissolved in the fog that vanished in the wind. Facing each other stood the mother and the daughter.
"Is it myself that I see in the deep water?" said the mother. "Is it myself that I see in the gleaming shield?" exclaimed the daughter. And they drew close to each other, breast against breast, embracing each other. The mother's heart beat more strongly, and she understood. "My child, flower of my own heart, my lotus from the deep waters."
And she embraced her child and wept. Her tears were a new life, the baptism of love for little Helga.
"In a swanskin I came here, casting it aside," said the mother. "I sank through the shifting flood, deep down in the marshy bog, which closed like a wall around me. But soon I felt a fresher current. A force kept driving me deeper, even deeper. I felt sleep pressing on my eyelids. I fell asleep. I dreamed. I thought I was once again lying inside the pyramid of Egypt. But in front of me still lay the rocking alder log that had frightened me on the surface of the bog. I looked at the cracks in the bark, and they glowed with colours and became hieroglyphics. It was the mummy's shroud I was looking at. It burst, and out stepped the thousand-year-old king, the mummy figure, black as pitch, gleaming black like a forest snail or the oily black marsh. The marsh king or the pyramid's mummy, I didn't know which. He wrapped his arms around me, and I felt as if I would die. I didn't sense life again, until my breast grew warm from a little bird flapping its wings inside, chirping and singing. The bird flew from my breast, high up toward the dark, heavy surface, but a long green ribbon still tied it to me. I heard its yearning cries and understood, freedom, sunshine, to father. Then I thought about my father back home in the sunlit land, my life, my love, and I released the ribbon, let it fly away, home to father. Ever since that moment I have not dreamed. I slept a sleep that was certainly deep and long, until this hour when sounds and scents lifted and released me.
The green ribbon, from the mother's heart to the bird's wings, where was it fluttering now? Where had it been tossed? Only the stork had seen it. The ribbon was the green stork, the bow, the gleaming flower, the cradle for the child who had now grown so lovely and once again rested at her mother's heart. And while they stood there, embracing each other, Stork Father flew in circles around them. Then he raced off to his nest, and there found the feather skins, hidden for years. He threw one over each of them. The skins closed around them, lifting them up from the ground as two white swans.
"Let's have a talk," said Stork Father, "now that we can understand each other's language, even though the beak may be cut differently on one bird than on the other. How fortunate it is that you came here tonight. Tomorrow we'll be gone, Mother, myself, and the children. We're flying south. Well, just take a look at me. I'm an old friend from the land of the Nile, and Mother is too, though more in her heart than in her beak. She always believed that a princess would take care of herself. The children and I carried the swan skins up here. Oh, how happy I am, and what good luck that I'm still here. When dawn comes, we'll be off, a big flock of storks, and we'll be flying in the lead. Just fly behind us, and you won't lose your way. The children and I will keep an eye on you."
"And I must bring the lotus blossom," said the Egyptian princess. "It will fly at my side, wearing a swan skin. I have the flower of my heart with me. That's how things have turned out. And so the riddle has been solved. Homeward, homeward!"
but Helga said that she couldn't leave the Danish land until she once again had seen her foster mother, the lovely Viking woman. In Helga's mind appeared every beautiful memory, every loving word, every tear her foster mother had wept, and at that moment it was almost as if she loved this mother more dearly than any other.
"Yes, we must go to the Viking manor," said Storkfather. "That's where mother and the children are waiting. How they will stare and clack their beaks! Well, mother doesn't say much. She's curt and to the point, but she has good intentions. I'll start clacking at once so they can hear we're coming."
Then Storkfather began clacking his beak, and the swans flew off to the Viking stronghold. Inside, everyone was still sleeping soundly. Not until late at night had the Viking woman fallen asleep. She lay there fearing for little Helga, who had been missing for 3 whole days, along with a Christian priest. She must have helped him escape. It was her horse that was gone from the stables. By what power had all of this taken place? The Viking woman thought about the miracles they had heard were performed by the White Christ and by those who believed in him and followed him. All these thoughts took shape in the realm of her dreams. It seemed to her that she was still awake, thinking in her bed, with the darkness brooding outside. A storm came. She heard the rolling of the sea to the west and the east, from the North Sea and the waters of the Kattegat. The monstrous serpent that encircled the earth in the depths of the sea was shaking with convulsions. The twilight of the gods was approaching. Ragnarok, as the heathen folk called the final hour, when everything would perish, even the high gods themselves. The Gjallar horn sounded, and over the rainbow rode the gods clad in steel to fight the last battle. Ahead of them flew the winged Valkyries, and behind them came the figures of dead warriors. The entire sky was lit up around them with the glow of northern lights, but darkness was the victor. It was a terrible hour. And on the floor, next to the terrified Viking woman, stood little Helga in the frog's hideous form. She too was shaking, and she pressed close to her foster mother, who took the child onto her lap and lovingly held her tight, no matter how hideous the frog's skin looked. The sky resounded with the blows of swords and clubs, with the rush of arrows, as if a raging hailstorm were passing overhead. The hour had come when heaven and earth would explode, the stars would fall, everything would be consumed in the fire of Surt. Yet she knew that a new earth and heaven would come. Grain would billow where the sea now rolled across the golden sandy bottom. The unnameable god would rule, and up to him would rise Baldur, gentle and loving, released from the realm of the dead. He was coming. The Viking woman saw him. She recognized his face. It was the captured Christian priest. "White Christ!" she called aloud, and as she spoke his name, she pressed a kiss to the forehead of the hideous frog child. Then the frog skin fell away, and little Helga stood there in all her loveliness, more gentle than ever before and with shining eyes. She kissed her foster mother's hands, blessing her for all the care and love the woman had given her during those days of trial and need, thanking her for the thoughts she had impressed upon and awakened in her, thanking her for speaking the name, which she repeated, "White Christ." And little Helga rose up as a mighty swan, spreading her wings out wide with a rushing sound made by flocks of migratory birds flying off. With that, the Viking woman awoke, and from outside she could still hear the same great flapping of wings. She knew it was time for the storks to leave. It was them she heard. She wanted to see them one more time before they departed, to bid them farewell. She stood up and went out onto the gallery. Then she saw on the roof of the outbuilding stork after stork. All around the manor, above the tall trees, flew flocks in great circles, but right in front of her, on the edge of the well where little Helga had so often sat and screamed at her in her wildness, 2 swans now sat, looking at her with wise eyes. And she remembered her dream. It still filled her mind whole, as if it were quite real. She thought about little Helga in the swan form. She thought about the Christian priest, and suddenly she felt a wondrous joy in her heart. The swans flapped their wings, bowed their heads, as if they too wanted to send a greeting, and the Viking woman stretched out her arms toward them as if she understood, smiling amid tears and all her whirling thoughts. Then, with a great flapping of wings and clacking beaks, all the storks rose up and started on their journey south.
"We're not waiting for the swans," said Stork Mother. "If they want to go with us, they'll just have to come. We can't stay here until the plovers leave. There's something so charming about travelling as a family after all, not like the chaffinches or reeves, where the males fly in one group and the females in another. Properly speaking, it's not decent. And what kind of way is that to flap your wings? What the swans are doing?"
"Everyone has his own way of flying," said Stork Father. "The swans fly on the diagonal, the cranes in a triangle, and the plovers like a snake in single file."
"Don't mention snakes when we're flying up here," said Stork Mother. "It will make the children want things they can't have."
"Are those the high mountains down there that I've heard about?" asked Helga in her swan skin.
"They're thunder clouds drifting below us," said her mother. "What are those white clouds rising so high up?" asked Helga.
"Those are the eternally snow-capped mountains that you're looking at," said her mother,
and they flew over the Alps, heading south toward the blue Mediterranean Sea.
"The lands of Africa, the shores of Egypt," rejoiced the daughter of the Nile, now in swan form, from high in the air as she glimpsed her homeland, like a wavy, yellowish-white stripe.
The birds, too, looked down and hastened their flight.
"I can smell the Nile marsh and the wet frogs," said Stork Mother. "I feel a tickling inside me. Oh, yes, now you're going to have tasty things to eat, and you'll see the marabou, the ibis, and the cranes. They're all related to our family, though not nearly as handsome as we are. They put on such airs, especially the ibis. He's been so pampered by the Egyptians. They make him into mummies, stuffing him with aromatic herbs. I'd rather be stuffed with live frogs, and you would too, and you will. Better to have something in your craw while you're alive than be put on display when you're dead. That's my opinion, and I'm always right."
"The storks have arrived,"
people said in the great house on the banks of the Nile. In the open hall, on soft cushions covered with leopard skin, the royal lord lay stretched out, neither alive nor dead, hoping for the lotus blossom from the deep bog in the north. Kinsmen and servants stood around him. Into the hall flew two magnificent white swans. They had come with the storks. They threw off their dazzling feather skins, and there stood two lovely women, looking as much alike as two drops of dew. They bent over the pale, withered old man. They tossed their long hair back, and as little Helga leaned over her grandfather, his cheeks flushed, his eyes grew bright, and life returned to his rigid limbs. The old man sat up, healthy and rejuvenated. Daughter and granddaughter took him in their arms, as if giving him a joyous morning greeting after a long, melancholy dream. And there was joy everywhere on the estate, and in the stork nest too, although there the greatest joy was over the good food, the swarms of frogs. And while the learned men in all haste wrote down a rough account of the story about the two princesses and the flower of health, which was a great event and a blessing for home and country, the stork parents spoke of it in their own way to their families, though not until they had all eaten their fill. They had other things to do, after all, than listen to stories.
"Now I'm sure you'll be given a title," whispered Stork Mother. "It's only reasonable."
"Oh, and what exactly would that be?" said Stork Father. "And what have I done? Nothing."
"You've done more than all the others. Without you and the children, the two princesses would never have seen Egypt again, or made the old man well. You'll get a title. I'm sure you'll be given the title of doctor, and then our children will inherit it, and their children after them. You already look like an Egyptian doctor, at least in my eyes."
The learned and wise formulated the basic principle, as they called it, that underlay the whole event.
"Love nourishes life."
They explained this in several ways.
"The warm ray of sun was the Egyptian princess.
She went down to the Marsh King, and from their encounter sprang the flower."
"I can't repeat their words exactly," said
Storkfather, who had listened from the rooftop and was trying to tell his family about it in the nest.
"What they said was so complicated and so wise that they were at once given presents and promotions in rank. Even the royal chef was given a grand medal of distinction. That was probably for the soup."
"And what did you get?" asked Stork Mother. "They can't forget the most important one of all, and that's you. The learned men just clacked their beaks over the whole thing, but I'm sure your turn will come."
Late at night, when the peace of slumber rested over the great happy house, there was one person still awake. And it wasn't Stork Father, in spite of the fact that he was standing on one leg in the nest, a sleeping sentry. No, little Helga was awake, leaning over the balcony and gazing at the clear sky with the great sparkling stars, bigger and purer in lustre than she had ever seen them in the north, and yet the same. She thought about the Viking woman at Wild Bog, about her foster mother's gentle eyes, about the tears she had wept over the poor frog child who now stood in the brilliant starry splendour near the waters of the Nile in the lovely spring air. She thought about the love in the heathen woman's breast, the love she had shown to the pitiful creature who in human guise was an evil animal, and in animal skin too beastly to look at or touch. She gazed at the glittering stars, and remembered the glow from the dead man's brow when they flew over forest and bog. His voice resounded in her memory, words she had heard spoken as they rode along, and she sat like someone bewitched, words about the greatest source of love, the highest love, that encompassed all creatures. Oh, what had not been given, won, achieved! Little Helga's thoughts dwelled by night and by day on the vast sum of her happiness, and were mesmerized by it like the child who turns swiftly from giver to what is given, to all those lovely gifts. She seemed caught up in the rising bliss that might come, would come. She was born through miracles to ever higher joy and happiness, and one day she lost herself so much in this that she gave no more thought to the giver. It was the rashness of youthful audacity making its impetuous move. And it made her eyes light up, but she was suddenly torn away by a great commotion in the courtyard below. There she saw two mighty ostriches swiftly racing around in tight circles. Never before had she seen such an animal, such a huge bird, so plump and heavy. Its wings looked as if they had been clipped, the bird itself as if it had been harmed. She asked what had happened to it, and for the first time she heard the legend the Egyptians tell about the ostrich. How lovely its kind had once been, its wings big and strong. Then one evening the forest's mighty birds said to it, "Brother, should we, God willing, fly to the river tomorrow to drink?" And the ostrich replied, "I'm willing." When day came they flew off, heading first high up toward the sun, God's eye, ever higher and higher, with the ostrich far ahead of all the others. It flew with pride toward the light. It put its trust in its own powers and not in the giver. It did not say, "God willing." Then the avenging angel drew aside the veil from the flaming radiance, and at that instant the bird's wings were singed. Miserable it sank to earth. The ostrich and its kin can never again rise up. It flees in terror, rushing around in circles in the narrow space, a reminder to us humans that in our thoughts, with every deed, we should say, "God willing." Helga thoughtfully bowed her head. She gazed at the racing ostrich, saw its fear, saw its foolish joy at the sight of its own huge shadow on the white sunlit wall, and in her mind sombre thoughts planted deep roots. A life so rich, moving toward happiness, had been given, won. What would happen? What was yet to come? The best, God willing. In early spring, when the storks once again headed north, little Helga took off her gold bracelet, scratched her name on it, and beckoned to Stork Father. She put the gold bracelet around his neck and asked him to take it to the Viking woman, who would then understand that her foster daughter still lived, was happy, and had not forgotten her.
"This is hard to carry," said the stork when the bracelet was put around his neck. "But you don't throw gold and honour into the road. They'll realize up there that good fortune comes with a stork.
You lay gold and I lay eggs, said Stork Mother, but you lay only once, and I've been doing it all these years, yet neither of us gets any appreciation. It's an outrage.
We have our good conscience, Mother, said Stork Father.
You can't wear that around your neck, said Stork Mother. It doesn't bring good winds or food.
And off they flew. The little nightingale who sang in the tamarind bush would soon be heading north too. Little Helga had often heard it singing up there at Wild Bog. She would give it a message to take along. She knew the language of the birds from the time she flew in a swan skin. Since then she had often talked to the stork and swallow. The nightingale would understand her, and she asked it to fly to the beech forest on the Jutland Peninsula, where she had made the grave of stones and boughs. She told it to ask all the little birds to protect the grave, and to sing a song, and then another. Off flew the nightingale, and time flew too. The eagle stood on the pyramid and saw in the autumn a stately caravan with richly laden camels. Armed men wearing costly attire rode snorting Arabian horses, shining white as silver and with quivering red nostrils. Their manes, thick and long, hung down around their elegant legs. Rich guests and a royal prince from the land of Arabia, handsome as a prince should be, entered the proud house where the stork's nest now stood empty. The birds who lived in it were in a northern country, of course, but soon they would return. They arrived on the day that was filled with the greatest joy and merriment, wedding splendour everywhere, and little Helga was the bride, dressed in silks and jewels. The bridegroom was the young prince from the land of Arabia. They sat at the head of the table between her mother and grandfather. But she wasn't looking at the bridegroom's brown, manly cheek, where his black beard curled. She wasn't looking at his fiery, dark eyes that were fixed on her. She was looking out, up at the glittering, sparkling star that shone down from the sky. Then came the rustling sound of strong wings flapping in the air. The storks had come back, and the old stork couple, no matter how weary they were from the journey and in need of rest, flew at once down to the railing on the veranda. They knew all about the celebration. They had already heard at the border of the country that little Helga had ordered their likeness to be painted on the wall. They were part of her story.
"How very thoughtful that was," said Stork Father.
"How very paltry," said Stork Mother. "It was the very least she could do."
When Helga saw them, she stood up and went out to them on the veranda to stroke their backs. The old stork couple bowed their necks as the youngest fledglings watched, feeling honoured. And Helga looked up at the glowing star that was shining brighter and brighter. Between her and the star, a figure was moving, even purer than the air, and that's why it was visible. It hovered quite close to her. It was the dead Christian priest. He too had come to her celebration from the kingdom of heaven.
"There the radiance and glory surpass anything known on earth," he said.
And little Helga prayed so tenderly, so fervently as she had never prayed before, that for one single moment she might see inside, take one brief glance inside the kingdom of heaven at the Father. Then he lifted her up in radiance and glory, in a stream of melodies and thoughts. It glowed and resounded not just all around her, but within her as well. Words cannot describe it.
"Now we must go back. You are missed," he said. "Just one more look," she begged, "just one more brief moment. We must go back to earth. All the guests have gone. Just one more look, one last."
And little Helga once again stood on the veranda. But all the torches there had been put out. All the lights in the bridal hall were gone. The storks were gone. No guests were to be seen, and no bridegroom. Everything had vanished in 3 short minutes. Then Helga grew frightened. She walked through the big empty hall into the next room. There foreign soldiers were sleeping. She opened the side door that led to her chambers, but when she thought she was standing inside, she was actually out in the garden. It was not like this before. The sky shone crimson. It was almost dawn. Only 3 minutes in heaven, and a whole night on earth had passed. Then she saw the storks. She called to them, speaking their language, and Stork Father turned his head, listened, and came closer.
"You speak our language," he said. "What is it you want? Why have you come here, strange woman?"
"But it's me. It's Helga. Don't you know me? 3 minutes ago we were talking together, over there on the veranda."
"You must be mistaken," said the stork. "You must have dreamed the whole thing."
"No! No," she said, and reminded him about the Viking stronghold, and about Wild Bog and the journey they had made.
Then Stork Father blinked his eyes.
"But that's an old story that I've heard from my great-great-great-grandmother's time. It's true that here in Egypt there was once such a princess from the land of Denmark, but she disappeared on her wedding night many hundreds of years ago, and she never returned. You can read about it yourself here on this monument in the garden. Swans and storks are carved on it, and at the very top you're standing there yourself in the white marble."
And what he said was true. Little Helga saw it, understood, and sank to her knees. The sun broke through. And as in the past, when its rays made the frog skin fall away and the lovely figure appear, now, at the baptism of light, a figure of beauty rose up, brighter and purer than air, a ray of light, to the Father. Her body sank into dust. A withered lotus blossom lay where she had stood.
"That was a new ending to the story," said Stork Father. "That's not what I expected at all, but I like it very much."
"What do you think the children will say about it?" asked Stork Mother.
"Well, of course, that's what counts the most," said Stork Father.
The Wind Tells of Valdemar Daux and His Daughters. When the wind runs across the grass, the blades ripple like a pond. When it runs across the field, the grain billows like a lake. That's the dance of the wind. But listen to it speak. It sings the words out loud, and the sound is different in the trees of the forest than through the holes, cracks, and crevices of the wall. Can you see how the wind up there is chasing the clouds as if they were a flock of sheep? Can you hear how the wind down here is sobbing through the open gate as if it were a watchman blowing his horn? How odd the way it rushes down the chimney and into the stove. The fire flares up and sparks, shining far into the room. It's so warm and snug to sit here and listen to it. Just let the wind speak. It knows tales and stories more than all the rest of us put together. Listen now to the way it speaks. Hoo, pass on. That's the refrain to the song. Near the Great Belt, there's an old manor house with thick red walls, says the wind. I know every stone. I saw it in the past, when it was part of Mersk Stee's castle on the headland. It had to come down. The stones rose up again to become a new wall, a new estate in a different place. That was Borreby Manor, which stands there today. I've seen and known all the high-born gentlemen and ladies, the different families who have resided there. Now I'm going to tell you about Valdemar Daux and his daughters. He held his head so proudly. He was of royal lineage. He could do more than hunt a stag and empty a tankard. Everything will turn out fine, he would say. His wife, straight-backed in a silk gown shot with gold threads, glided along her polished parquet floor. The tapestries were magnificent, the furniture costly and artfully carved. Silverware and gold she had brought to the house. German beer was stored in the cellar when there was beer to be had, and fiery black horses snorted in the stable. There were great riches at Borreby Manor while the wealth lasted. And there were children, 3 elegant maidens, Ida, Johanna, and Anna Dorothea. I can still remember their names. They were wealthy people, refined people, born into glory and raised in it. Hoo, hoo, pass on, sang the wind. and then resumed its story. There I never saw, as I did at the other old manors, the high-born mistress sitting in the great hall with her maids turning the spinning wheel. She played the lilting lute and sang along, though not always the old Danish folk ballads, but rather songs in foreign tongues. The house was lively and festive. Distinguished guests came from far and near. Music played, goblets clinked. I couldn't drown them out, said the wind. There was an arrogance beyond all measure. Noble folks, but not our lord. Then on the evening of May Day, said the wind, I came from the west. I had seen ships smashed to wrecks on the west coast of Jutland. I had raced over the heath and the forest green shore, across the island of Fern, and then crossed the great belt, soaring and roaring. Then I lay down to rest on the coast of Sjeland, close to Borreby Manor, where the forest still stood with glorious oaks. The young men from the region came there to gather boughs and branches, the biggest and driest they could find. They took them to town, placed them in a heap, and set fire to it. Then the girls and young men danced around the fire, singing. I lay still, said the wind, but I gently moved one branch, the one that had been put there by the most handsome of the young men. His wood flared up, flared highest of all. He was the chosen one, awarded a title and proclaimed the May King. He chose from among the girls his little May Queen. There was joy and merriment greater than inside the rich Borreby Manor. And approaching the manor in a golden carriage drawn by 6 horses came the noble mistress and her 3 daughters, so elegant, so young. 3 enchanting flowers, rose, lily, and the pale hyacinth. Their mother was a resplendent tulip. Not one person in the whole crowd did she greet as they stopped their games to curtsy and bow. You'd almost think the mistress was brittle like a stork. Rose, Lily, and the pale hyacinth. Yes, I saw all 3. I thought to myself, whose May Queen will they be some day? Their May King a proud knight, perhaps a prince? Ooh, pass on, pass on. Yes, the carriage rushed off with them, and the peasant folk rushed back to the dance. Preparations were made for summer in the town near Borreby, near Cheribu, in all the surrounding towns. But that night, when I rose up, said the wind, the high-born mistress lay down, never to rise again. It came upon her as it comes upon all humans. It's nothing new. For a brief moment, Valdemar Dürr stood there, solemn and passive. The proudest tree may be bowed, but never broken, he heard a voice say inside him. His daughters wept, and at the manor everyone wiped their eyes, but Mistress Dürr had passed on. And I passed on. Hoo-hoo, said the wind. I went back. I went back often across the island of Fern and the waters of the Great Belt. I sat down on Borreby Strand near the magnificent oak forest. There the osprey, the wood dove, the blue raven, and even the black stork built their nests. It was early in the year. Some had eggs, and some had fledglings. Oh, how they flew, how they shrieked! The crash of axes could be heard, blow after blow. The forest was going to be felled. Valdemar Dürr wanted to build a costly ship, a man of war with 3 foredecks, which the king was certain to buy. That's why the forest had to fall, that landmark for the sailors, that home for the birds. The shrike flew off in terror, its nest was destroyed. The osprey and all the birds of the forest lost their homes. They flew around in confusion, shrieking in fear and anger. I understood them well. Crows and jackdaws jeered loudly, "Gone the nest! Gone the nest! Gone! Gone!" And in the middle of the forest, near the crowd of workers, stood Valdemar Dürr and his 3 daughters. They were all laughing at the wild screams of the birds, but his youngest daughter, Anna Dorothea, felt pity in her heart. They were also going to fell a half-dead tree on whose bare branches the black stork had built its nest, and the little fledglings were poking out their heads. She pleaded for them, pleaded with tears in her eyes, and so the tree was allowed to stay, keeping its nest for the black stork. It was a mere trifle. They chopped and they sawed. A ship was built with 3 foredecks. The master builder was of lowly lineage, but of noble countenance. His eyes and brow revealed how wise he was, and Valdemar Daux liked to hear his stories, as did little Ida, the eldest daughter, a girl of 15. And while he built the ship for her father, he built for himself a dream castle, in which he and little Ida lived as man and wife. That might have happened if only the castle had been made of mortared stone and ramparts and trenches, woods and gardens. But for all his shrewdness, the master builder was still an impoverished bird. And what place does a sparrow have in a crane's mating dance? Hoo! I flew away and he flew away, for he didn't dare stay, and little Ida recovered from it, because recover she must. In the stables snorted the black horses, worth seeing, and seen they were. The admiral was sent by the king himself to take a look at the new man of war and discuss its purchase. He spoke in loud admiration of the fiery horses. "I heard it myself," said the wind. "I followed the gentlemen through the open door and spread the straw like rods of gold before their feet." Gold was what Valdemar Daux wanted. The admiral wanted the black horses, for he praised them so highly. But this was not understood, and so the ship was never sold. It stood and gleamed at the shore, covered with planks, a Noah's Ark that never entered the water. "Hoo, pass on, pass on!" What a pity that was. In the winter time, when the fields lay under snow, drift ice filled the strait, and I packed it against the shore, said the wind. Ravens and crows arrived, each one blacker than the last, in huge flocks. They landed on that desolate, that dead, that lonely ship at the shore, and screamed their hoarse cries about the forest that was gone, the many precious birds' nests that had been destroyed, the homeless old ones, the homeless young, and all for the sake of this great junk heap, this proud vessel that would never set sail. I whirled the snow into drifts. The snow lay like great swells rising high on all sides, rising over it. I let it hear my voice, what a storm has to say. I know I did my utmost to give it the knowledge a ship should have. Hoo, pass on! And winter passed on, both winter and summer passed on. They race by and they pass on, just as I race by, just as the snow drifts, the apple blossom drifts, and the leaf falls. Pass on, pass on, pass on. So too must human beings. But the daughters were still young. Little Ida, a rose as lovely to look at as when the shipbuilder saw her. Often I would seize hold of her long brown tresses when she stood in the garden near the apple tree, lost in thought, not noticing that I was sprinkling blossoms onto her hair which had come undone. And she gazed at the red sun and the golden backdrop of sky between the dark shrubs and trees of the garden. Her sister was like a lily, shimmering and straight. Johanna, her bearing noble and erect, and like her mother, a brittle stalk. She took pleasure in walking through the great hall where the ancestral portraits hung. The ladies were painted wearing velvet and silk, with tiny pearl-studded caps on their plaited hair. What beautiful ladies! Their husbands wore steel, or costly cloaks lined with squirrel skin with blue pleated ruffs. Their swords were fastened to their thigh and not to their waist. Where would Johanna's portrait one day hang on the wall? How would her noble husband look? Yes, that's what she thought about. That's what she chattered about. I heard it as I passed through the long corridor into the hall and then turned around. Anna Dorothea, the pale hyacinth, a mere child of 14, was quiet and pensive. Her big, pale blue eyes looked thoughtful, but a childish smile played on her lips. I could not blow it away, nor did I wish to.
End of Disc 8.
I met her in the garden, on the sunken road, and in the surf-tended fields. She was gathering herbs and flowers, the ones she knew that her father could use in the potions and tinctures he was distilling. Valdemar Daux was arrogant and proud, but also skillful and possessed of great knowledge. People had taken note of this, and there was much talk. The fire burned in his hearth even in summer. His chamber door was locked. This went on for days and nights, but he said very little about it. The forces of nature must be quietly explored. Soon he would discover the very best. Red gold. That's why steam poured from the hearth. That's why it crackled and blazed. Oh, yes, I was there, explained the wind. Let it go, let it go, I sang through the chimney. It will be nothing but smoke, soot, embers, and ashes. You'll burn yourself up. Hoo, hoo, pass on, pass on. But Valdemar Daux did not let it go. The magnificent horses in the stable. What happened to them? What about the old silverware and gold in the cupboards and bowers, the cows in the fields, the lands and estate? Well, they could be melted. Melted in the gold crucible, and yet no gold appears. There was nothing left in the barn or storerooms, in the cellar or attic. Fewer servants, more mice. One window pane shattered, another cracked. I no longer had to go through the door, said the wind. When the chimney is smoking, a meal is cooking. And the chimney smoked, the one that devours all meals for the sake of red gold. I blew through the castle gate like a watchman blowing his horn, but there was no watchman, said the wind. I spun the weather vane on the steeple. It creaked as if the watchman were snoring on the tower, but there was no watchman. There were rats and mice. Poverty set the table. Poverty sat in the wardrobe and in the pantry. The door came off its hinges. Cracks and crevices appeared. I went out and I went in, said the wind. That's why I know all about it. In smoke and ashes, in sorrow and sleepless nights, the hair in his beard and on his brow turned grey, his skin grimy and yellow, his eyes so greedy for gold, the long-awaited gold. I blew smoke and ashes into his face and beard. Debts appeared instead of gold. I sang through the broken panes and open cracks, blew at his daughter's sleeping benches where their clothes lay faded and threadbare because they had to last forever. That song was not sung at the cradle of these children. The noble life became a wretched life. I was the only one who sang aloud in the castle, said the wind. I snowed them in because that's said to bring warmth. They had no firewood. The forest where they should have found wood had been felled. It was a bitter frost. I swung through sound holes and corridors, over gables and walls to keep myself brisk. Inside they lay in their beds because of the cold, those noble daughters. Their father crept under the hide coverlet. Nothing to bite and nothing to burn, that's the noble life. Hoo, hoo, pass on. But Sir Daux could not. After winter comes spring, he said. After bad times come good. But they're long overdue. Long overdue. Now the manor has been mortgaged. Now is the time of our greatest need, and so the gold will come at Easter. I heard him muttering to the spider's web. You clever little weaver. You've taught me to keep going. If your web is torn apart, you start over and complete it. Torn apart again and undismayed, you set to work from the beginning. The beginning! That's what a person has to do, and he will be rewarded. It was Easter morning. The bells chimed. The sun played in the sky. Burning with fever, he had kept vigil, boiling and cooling, mixing and distilling. I heard him sigh like a desperate soul. I heard him pray. I could sense that he was holding his breath. The lamp had gone out. He didn't notice. I blew on the charcoal embers. They shone on his chalk-white face. It took on a tinge of colour. His eyes were squinting in their deep sockets, but now they grew bigger, bigger, as if they would burst. Look at that alchemical flask. Something is shining inside. It's gleaming, pure and heavy. He lifted it up with a trembling hand. He shouted with a trembling tongue, "Gold! Gold!" And with that he grew faint. I could have blown him over, said the wind. But I merely blew on the glowing coals and followed him through the door to where his daughters sat freezing. His coat was covered with ashes. They hung in his beard and in his tangled hair. He drew himself up tall, lifted his precious treasure in the fragile flask. "Discovered," "Recovered! Gold!" he cried, holding high the flask which sparkled in the sunlight. But his hand shook, and the flask dropped to the floor and shattered into 1,000 pieces. Burst was the last bubble of his well-being. "Hoo! Pass on!" And I rushed from the alchemist's manor. Late in the year, when the days are short up here, when the fog arrives with its dishrag and rings wet drops onto the red berries and the leafless branches, I arrived in a cheerful mood to air things out. I blew the air clean and snapped off rotten branches, and that's not a huge task, but it has to be done. Things were swept clean in another way at Borreby Manor, the home of Valdemar Daux. His enemy, Ove Rammel from Basness, had come with the purchased mortgage deed in hand for the estate and all its contents. I drummed on the broken window panes, slammed the ramshackle doors, whistled through the cracks and crevices. Hoo-wee! Sir Ove would have no desire to stay there. Ida and Anna Dorothea wept brave tears. Johanna stood straight-backed and pale, chewing her thumb until it bled. What good would that do? Ove Rammel granted Sir Daux permission to stay at the manor for the rest of his life, but he won no thanks for his offer. I was listening. I saw the landless gentleman raise his head even prouder, giving it a toss, and I blew a gust at the estate and the old linden trees, breaking the thickest branch in half, though it wasn't even rotten. It lay in front of the gate like a broom if anyone wanted to do any sweeping. And sweep they did. I thought as much. It was a hard day, a bitter hour to endure, but the will was stubborn, the neck was stiff. Not a thing did they possess but the clothes on their backs. Oh yes, the alchemical flask that had been recently purchased and filled with scrapings from what had spilled on the floor, the promised treasure that had failed to last. Valdemar Daux hid it inside his waistcoat, then took his stick in hand, and the once rich gentleman and his three daughters left Borreby Manor. I blew cold air on his hot cheeks. I caressed his grey beard and his long white hair. I sang the only way I know how. Hoo-hoo! Pass on! Pass on! That was the end of their rich splendour. Ida and Anna Dorothea walked on either side of him. Johanna turned around at the gate. What good was that? Their fortunes were not about to turn. She looked at the red stones in the wall that came from Mersk Stee's castle. She thought about his daughters. The eldest took the youngest's hand, and they set off into the wide world. She thought about that song. Here were the three of them. Their father was with them too. They were walking along the road they once had travelled in a carriage. They were setting off as beggars with their father for Smidstrup Field, to the mud and wattle hovel they had leased for 10 marks a year, their new manor house with empty walls and empty vessels. Crows and jackdaws flew above them, screeching as if in spite. "Gone the nest! Gone the nest! Gone! Gone!" just as the birds had screeched in Borreby Forest when the trees were felled. Sir Daux and his daughters certainly heard it, but I blew hard at their ears. It wasn't worth hearing. Then they went inside the mud and wattle hovel at Smidstrup Field, and I rushed across bog and field, through naked hedges and plucked forests to open waters, other lands. Hoo-hoo! Pass on, pass on! And keep on for years and years. What happened to Valdemar Daux? What happened to his daughters? The wind says, "The last I saw of them, yes, the very last, it was Anna Dorothea, the pale hyacinth. By then she was old and bowed. It was half a century later. She had lived the longest. She knew the whole story. Over there on the heath near the town of Vibor stood the dean's stately new manor with red stones and a stepped gable. Thick smoke rose from the chimney. The gentle mistress and her fair daughters sat in the bay window and gazed out over the garden's drooping boxthorn, out toward the brown heath. What were they looking for? They were looking for the stork's nest out there on the tumble-down house. The roof was covered with moss and house leeks. What was left of the roof? It was the stork's nest that provided the most cover, and it was the only thing that had been mended. The stork kept it in good repair. It was a house to be looked at, but not touched. I had to move cautiously, said the wind. For the sake of the stork's nest, the house was allowed to stand, otherwise it was an eyesore on the heath. But the dean didn't want to chase the stork away, so the hovel was allowed to remain, and the poor person inside was permitted to live there. For that she could thank the Egyptian bird. Or was it gratitude because she had once pleaded for the nest of his wild black brother in Borabu Forest? Back then the poor thing was a young girl, an elegant pale hyacinth in the noble garden. She remembered it all, Anna Dorothea. Oh, oh! Yes, human beings can sigh just like the wind does through the reeds and rushes. Oh, no bells tolled over your grave, Valdemar Doe. The poor schoolboys did not sing when the former lord of Borabu was laid in the earth. Oh, everything comes to an end, even misery. Sister Ida became a peasant's wife. That was the harshest trial for our father. His daughter's husband, a wretched thrall, subject to the master's punishment to ride the wooden horse. Surely by now he must be in his grave, and you as well. Ida. Oh, yes, oh, yes. It is not yet over, old wretch that I am. Poor wretch that I am. Release me, mighty Christ. That was Anna Dorothea's prayer in the pitiful hovel that was allowed to stand for the sake of the stork. The most spirited sister I took care of myself, said the wind. She had clothes made to match the spirit that was hers at birth. She appeared as a poor lad and hired on with a ship's captain. Few in words, sullen in looks, but willing to do her job, although she could not climb. Then I blew her overboard before anyone found out that she was a woman. What a good thing I did, said the wind. It was Easter morning, just like the time when Valdemar Doe thought he had discovered red gold, when I heard beneath the stork's nest between the flimsy walls a hymn, Anna Dorothea's last song. There was no window pane, there was merely a hole in the wall. The sun appeared like a lump of gold and settled there. How it glowed! Her eyes burst, her heart burst. They would have done so even if the sun had not shone on her that morning. The stork gave her a roof over her head until her death. I sang at her grave, said the wind. I sang at her father's grave. I know where it is and where hers is too, but no one else knows. New times, other times, old thoroughfares lead to fenced fields, hallowed graves become frequented highways, and soon the steam engine will come with its strings of cars and roar over the graves, forgotten just like the names. Hoo-hoo, pass on. That's the story of Valdemar Doe and his daughters. Go ahead and tell it better, the rest of you. If you can, said the wind, and turned away. It was gone. The Snowman.
I'm creaking all over, it's so wondrously cold, said the snowman. The wind can certainly bite life into a person. And how that glowering creature over there is glaring.
It was the sun, he meant. It was just about to go down.
She's not going to make me blink. I know how to hold on to my tiles.
He had two big triangular roof tiles for his eyes. His mouth was part of an old rake, and that's why he had teeth. He was born to the boys' shouts of hurrah, greeted with the clanging of bells and the crack of whips from the sleighs. The sun went down. The full moon rose, big and round, bright and lovely in the blue sky.
There we have her again from a different direction, said the snowman.
He thought it was the sun that had reappeared.
I've taught her not to glare. Now she can hang there and shine so I can see myself.
If only I knew what to do so I could move. I would dearly like to move. If I could do that, I would go down and slide around on the ice the way the boys were doing. But I don't know how to run.
Gone! Gone!
Barked the old watchdog. He was rather hoarse, and had been that way ever since he was the house pet and lay under the stove.
The sun will surely teach you to run. I saw that happen to your predecessor last year.
and to his predecessor too. Gone. Gone. Every one of them gone.
I don't understand what you're saying, my friend, said the snowman. Is that thing up there supposed to teach me to run? He meant the moon.
Well, it's true that she ran off before when I gave her a stern look. Now she's sneaking up from a different direction. You don't know a thing, said the watchdog. But then you've only recently been padded together. What you're looking at is called the moon. The one that left is the sun. She'll be back in the morning, and she'll teach you to run down to the moat. We'll soon have a change in the weather. I can feel it in my left hind leg. I've got a shooting pain in it. Would you for a change in the weather?
I don't understand him, said the snowman, but I have the feeling that he's telling me something unpleasant. The one that was shining and went down, the one he calls the sun, I have a feeling that she's not my friend either.
Gone! Gone!
Barked the watchdog, as he spun around three times and then lay down inside his house to sleep. A change in weather truly did come. A fog, thick and damp, spread in the early morning hour over the entire region. At dawn came a light breeze. The wind was so icy that the frost took a firm grip, but what a sight there was when the sun came up. All the trees and shrubs were covered with rime. It looked like an entire forest of white corals, as if all the branches were heaped with dazzling white flowers. The infinitely numerous and delicate network of branches, which is impossible to see in the summer because of all the leaves, now appeared, every single twig. It was a lacework, and so glittering white, as if a white glow were streaming from every branch. The weeping birch stirred in the wind. There was life in it, like in the trees during the summer. It was lovely beyond compare. And when the sun shone, oh, how everything sparkled, as if powdered with diamond dust, and all across the snow on the ground glittered huge diamonds. Or you might also think that countless tiny little candles were burning, even whiter than the white snow. It is lovely beyond compare, said the young girl who had come into the garden with a young man and stopped right next to the snowman to look at the glittering trees. There's no sight as lovely as this in the summertime, she said, and her eyes shone.
And a lad like that we wouldn't find at all, said the young man, pointing at the snowman. He's splendid.
The young girl laughed, nodded at the snowman, and then danced with her friend across the snow, which creaked under them as if they were treading on starch.
Who are those two? The snowman asked the watchdog. You've been on the manor longer than I have. Do you know them? Yes, I do, said the watchdog. She once petted me, and he once gave me a meat bone. Those two I wouldn't bite.
But what are they doing here? Asked the snowman.
Sweethearts, said the watchdog. They're going to move into a doghouse together and gnaw on bones. Gone. Gone.
Are those two just as important as you and I? Asked the snowman.
They belong to the master's family, of course, said the watchdog. How little a person knows when he's born yesterday. I can see that about you. I have age and knowledge. I know everyone here on the manor. And I've known a time when I didn't have to stand out here in the cold on a chain. Gone. Gone.
The cold is lovely, said the snowman. Tell me more, tell me more. But you mustn't rattle your chain, because it makes me creak inside.
Gone, gone, barked the watchdog. A pup I once was. Little and charming, they said. Back then I lay on the velvet chair inside the manor. Lay on the laps of the whole family. They kissed me on the snout and wiped my paws with embroidered handkerchiefs. I was called the loveliest and little doggy. But then I got too big for them, so they gave me to the housekeeper. I wound up in the cellar. You can look down into it from where you're standing. You can look right into the room where I was the master because I was living with the housekeeper. It was a more modest place than upstairs, I suppose, but more comfortable. I wasn't hugged and hauled around by the children the way I was upstairs. The food was just as good as before, and there was more of it. I had my own pillow, and there was a stove. At this time of year, that's the loveliest thing in the world. I crept all the way under it so I was completely out of sight. Oh, I still dream about that stove. Gone. Gone.
Does a stove look so lovely? Said the snowman.
Does it look like me?
It's just the opposite of you. It's coal black, with a long neck and a brass belly. It devours wood so that fire pours out of its mouth. You have to keep to one side of it, very close, right underneath. Oh, such boundless comfort. You should be able to see it through the window from where you're standing.
And the snowman looked, and he actually saw a black polished object with a brass belly. Fire was glowing inside it down below. A strange feeling came over the snowman. He couldn't explain it. Something came over him that he didn't recognize, but that all humans recognize, as long as they're not snowmen.
And why did you leave her? Said the snowman. He felt that the stove had to be a female creature. How could you ever leave such a place?
Well, I was forced to, said the watchdog. They threw me outside and put me here on a chain. I bit the youngest squire on the leg because he kicked away the leg bone I was gnawing on,